My castaway this week is a fashion designer, the son of famous parents who divorced when he was very young. It wasn't until he left his English public school education for art college in New York that his career began to take shape. In 1977, still only 18, he returned to London. He got a bank loan and he started his own business. Less than 10 years later, he was voted Fashion Designer of the Year. Today, age 35, he remains a fashionable success, admired not just for his classic clothes, but his designs for theatre and ballet as well. In a family like mine, he says, if you're not successful, you drown. He is Jasper Conran. Have you ever felt you were drowning in the midst of this Conran clan, Jasper?
Oh, yes, quite frequently. Really, quite frequently.
But the name Conran is one which immediately suggests superwoman and superman, indeed, and style and success and all of these things. That there must have been a terrific onus upon you to achieve.
Yes, is the answer, definitely, because otherwise I was always going to be my parents' son.
But you had to say, how do you do, my name is Jasper Conran.
Yes. Certainly I encountered prejudice.
Did you?
Yes.
In what way?
Well, because everybody thought it would be easy for me. You know, my brother had had a terrible time at art school. My father was on the board of governors of most of the art schools. So how do you get into an art school without anybody thinking that you've been got in by the back door, so to speak?
But do you think that if you hadn't had the name, that Vogue would still have given you, as they did when you were 19 years old, virtually unknown, they gave you a 6-page spread? Now, wasn't it the name Conran that got you that?
I don't actually believe it was, because Vogue is a commercial enterprise. And whoever the fashion editor was certainly didn't do it for the love of me or for the name Conran. I think probably I was designing the right clothes at the right time. Perhaps the only reason she actually got to see my clothes was because of my name. Mm. Now, that I'm willing to concede.
OK.
Yes.
Well, we'll talk more about the Conran clan in a minute, but tell me, first of all, you have a very specific view, as I understand it, about how you arrive at this desert island. Now, tell me about that.
Well, to just jump off the side of a boat isn't very glamorous now, is it? I think I've been on a wonderful yacht. It's probably some 30s yacht that's been sailing through the Caribbean. It probably belonged to some amazing millionaireess. Finally, it breathes its last, this boat, and it blows up spectacularly. And I swim ashore.
So you sit down and attempt to turn it into a stylish minimalist paradise, is that right?
Yes, I think so. Probably lots of navy blue gingham and stripes and just hints of colour here and there, yes.
the odd cushion thrown around
the
on the beach.
Brightly coloured cushion.
And the music. Let's get down to the music. Tell me about your first record. What are you going to play when you get to this place?
My first record would be Billie Holiday singing On the Sunny Side of the Street. Billie Holiday reminds me of my mother very much. You know, I've been listening to her playing it and then me playing it. And so I'd want to remember my mother, I think, yes.
Grab your coat and get your hat. Leave your worry on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. Can't you hear a pit-a-pat? And that happy tune is your step. Life can be so sweet on the sunny side of the street.
Billie Holiday singing Sunny Side of the Street. In fact, all your records I see are women vocalists.
Yes, it's my all-girl lineup. The thing about women is that they're a good deal nicer than men in many respects.
Because you were brought up mainly by women. Your parents divorced when you were two.
Yes.
And you were brought up by mother, grandmother,
by
and great-grandmother
my mother and my
as well, right?
Great-grandmother, yes, indeed. She was a fabulous woman.
So you were kind of weaned on gossip and girl talk?
Yes, I was, you see. I used to get taken around by my grandmother to my great-grandmother's house every day for tea, and I would sit and listen. They thought I couldn't talk. I could talk very well, but I was too fascinated by their gossiping.
But you didn't talk, did you? You didn't.
No, I didn't talk until I was 4 years old.
I wonder why.
It could be that I'd had a quite traumatic time.
Because of your parents separating when you were so little?
Yes. I mean, my mother was working and I was left in the hands of nannies, and certainly one of my nannies used to lock me up and go out the minute my mother had left. And
but you didn't open your mouth and tell your
mother? Well, I mean, no. You see, and if you're not spoken to, you don't actually talk. So...
But nevertheless, you love women. Even,
now I,
even
haven't,
nasty
I don't, haven't stopped talking since I did open my mouth, however.
You like women, as I say.
Yes.
You like dressing women. You make them look very female.
What I try to do is follow the lines of a woman's shape. I don't make androgynous-looking clothes. I make female clothes. That is the shape of a woman. That's the shape we make the clothes in.
But they're also very classic. They're often navy blue or black.
Oh, yes. My favourite colours have always been navy blue and black and white. I find myself always saying, oh, well, we'll do this in pink, and then, no, it'll look much better in black.
But how many ways are there to design the little navy blue suit?
Oh, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. You change the shaping of the jacket, you change the proportions, you change the... I mean, I believe that clothes should... work for you. They should do a job to make you feel good, to make you feel confident.
One could say, but that's just you being a rather astute businessman. You are buying clothes that women will wear, not things that will be photographed and talked about in newspapers. Is that you, the businessman, at work there, or is it actually something perhaps...
Well, there's always an economical factor to being in the fashion business. It's a minefield of horror. And for sure, I have to make clothes that sell because I'd be out of business very quickly.
Tell me about record number two.
Oh, record number two. It would make me think of my father. He loves Dusty Springfield, and so do I. And I think that the song is a very appropriate one.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along. When they gathered around and started talking, Cousin Billy would take me walking. Out through the backyard we go walking. Then he'd look into my eyes. Lord knows, to my surprise, the only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Yes, he was.
Dusty Springfield with Son of a Preacher Man. So, Jasper Connon, your parents parted when you were two, we said.
Yes.
Just about when your father, Terence, was setting up Habitat, it must have been.
I think he set up Habitat in 1964, so that was just a little bit later.
A little bit later.
He had Conran Design Group then, I think.
Yeah. Your mother, Shirley, hadn't made a name for herself at that stage, had she?
Well, she had, because she'd been designing Conran Fabrics. That's what she ran. And that was a very successful company at the
time. But she went on to become woman's editor of The Observer.
She did.
And you were this little boy at home, very silent, as we've heard, very detached by all accounts. And you went on being detached, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I built a sort of emotional barrier around myself that was impregnable.
But you were sent away to school. How did you get on there? Did you retain the barrier?
Yes, I think I did. I think I did all the time that I was at school. I was fat, and children are very cruel to fat children, you know.
How
so
fat?
All 13 stone fat. As you can see, I'm not very tall. One day I looked in the mirror and I thought, this has got to stop. And I just stopped eating.
How old were you then?
I was 13, and I was just sick of the whole thing, you know. But I started running, I started doing all sorts of things that I'd never done before because I never had the confidence to do them. And suddenly I was in the rugby team, suddenly I was in the football team, suddenly, you know, I'd always been the one standing on the sideline in goal.
So you lost a lot of weight very quickly.
I lost a lot of weight very quickly, and I think I was on the verge of having anorexia because I became utterly obsessed by my weight. But I think probably my great love of food saved me from that.
So you obviously
thankfully.
a bit of a mess, if I can say so.
A mess? Terrible mess. God, I wouldn't have wanted to know me at all.
How did the other boys treat you? If you were so silent and detached and fat and...
Oh, just terrible.
I mean, did they bully you?
Yes, they bullied me because of my weight, but they soon learned that wasn't a very clever thing to do.
I was very, very strong. Did they then think you were quite extraordinary? Because you also had this very unusual mother who would come whizzing in to visit you.
Oh, God, yes. Everybody's mother always shames them. Well, my mother turned up one day at school, and she had a gold sports car at the time. And she came late, skidding in, and emerged from the car, to my horror, in a crocheted dress. She wasn't wearing a bra. Oh. And that was 1968. Of course, now I'm terribly proud of her for doing that. But
and what about your father? Because during this time, he'd remarried, hadn't he?
Yes, he married my stepmother, Caroline Conran, very quickly.
And he had more children. So yes. One way and another, your nose must have been pretty out of joint.
Oh, no. Never, ever. I've known my stepmother all my life and loved her all my life. I adore her. And I was thrilled by my brothers and sister. No, never out of joint.
But you've said before now that you always felt, nevertheless, when you went to their house, that you were a visitor.
Well, yes, but that wasn't their fault. It was a fact. Certainly, I think my stepmother did everything in her power to encourage me, and she taught me to cook, and she looked after me in the holidays. But you slightly do feel that you should be on your best behaviour. I've never been resentful about the situation, because I think, would I like my mother and my father in the same house? And the answer is a resounding no, thank you very much.
Next piece of music, what's that?
The next one is Janis Joplin singing Summertime, and it brings the whole feeling of early adolescence back to me, learning to smoke and drink scrumpy down in the bushes at school. And I didn't like school. I liked the smoking and drinking part down in the bushes in the fields with my mates.
Summertime, time.
Janis Joplin singing Summertime. Do you think, Jasper, that you always had an instinct for fashion? I mean, did you draw as a child? Or?
Oh, yes. I think I did always have an instinct, because I always remember looking at people, at my aunt and or something, and thinking, that length of dress will never do, just won't do, and making her take them up. All her dresses and her skirts.
How old would you have been when you did that?
No, 8.
Really?
Quite horribly precocious in that way, yes.
You're just saying your skirt is too long, or you look
better in that jacket. Your skirt is too long, you look dreadful.
It's amazing, no. Isn't it?
Actually, I always used to look at people and think, I could make you look so much better. And I'd dream of what I'd do to them.
So you brush away and then draw and
yes, I draw and create and draw and draw. I mean, I spent a lot of my childhood just drawing. I still do.
So your big opportunity came when you were, I think, only 15. Your mother took you to New York.
Yes.
And basically, you asked to be left there.
I'd finished my A-levels that summer. And my mother had a friend who came to see her. And she worked on Cosmopolitan. She saw my drawings, and she said, oh, you should go and see our art editor, you know, and art director, and show him your drawings. So I thought, well, why not? That'll be something to do. And then I went to see him, and he said, oh, well, you should be going to Parsons School of Art.
Which is big. I mean, it's the New
York
equivalent.
Which is like the Royal College.
Yes.
So I thought, well, why not? I was just passing the time of day, really, you know, filling in time. And so I went to see them, and they said, yes, yes, we'll give you a scholarship. Lovely, come quick. And
so you were 15 years old.
I was 15
years old. And basically wanting to be left there. Your mother was coming back to London.
I wanted to go to art school. I didn't want to go back to Bryanston, which I had outgrown.
Your school?
Yes.
You didn't want to do A-levels?
No. Well, I knew what I wanted to do with my life.
But it's remarkable.
And I was right. I'm still here doing it.
But it's remarkable that your parents agreed, really, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, I was talking to my mother.
There are many mothers who would leave a 15-year-old on his own in New York.
No, I was talking to my mother last night about it. And I said, well, how did you feel? I mean, that's an amazing thing to do now I think about it. And she said, I knew that you had done something special by getting a scholarship to that school, and I couldn't send you back. I knew that that was your only way of going forward.
Record number 4.
Gloria Gaynor singing I Will Survive. New York at that time was having the birth of the disco. This song was definitely the song of that moment.
But then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong, and I grew strong, and I learned how to get along. And saw your back from out of space. I just walked in to find you here with that sad look upon your face. I should have changed that stupid lock. I should have made you leave your key. If I'd have known for just 1 second.
Gloria Gaynor and I Will Survive. This is your dancing record.
Oh, it's my dancing. I've been dancing while you've been playing it.
But when you were 16 happens. And 17 and in New York,
absolutely.
Going to all the clubs.
Yes, absolutely. 5 a night, get back at 8 in the morning and go to school.
Did you get chucked out of Parsons in the end?
Oh, yes, I was thrown out for being a disruptive influence. I talked in class. Having started talking, I carried on and on and on and on and on.
But you had a good time.
Yes.
You really did the scene. I mean, you went to the club scene, I mean, straight
yes.
clubs and gay
yes.
clubs and Brazilian clubs. And
transvestite clubs and you name it. I mean, seeing this was amazing, coming from a very sort of narrow upbringing at school, not at home, but at school. I had no conception that life could be like quite like this. I was really looking through the eyes of a child, you see. Mm. I was, to all intents and purposes, still only 16. Golly, if you went into one of these Puerto Rican clubs, there was a pile of knives and guns and what have you at the door. They do, you know, they wouldn't take drugs off them. They'd take their knives and guns off them. It was quite amazing.
But you went out with women at this time, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
in fact,
I did.
You ended up marrying one of them.
Yes, I did.
That was when you came back here.
Yes.
You married at 19.
Yes, I was married at 19.
How long did the marriage last?
Ooh, couple of years. I had really married my best friend at the time, and we were both young. You know, people make an awful big deal about me getting married and then getting divorced. I mean, you know, people do it all the time, let's face it.
Well, absolutely. why they do in your case is because since then you've come out and
you are
happy to say that you are homosexual.
Yes, of course.
Was that a big deal for you to say that? How old were you when you came out?
I was never in. In all sorts of ways, I don't think. I think what is a misconception is that if you're homosexual, you cannot have a sexual relationship with a woman. That's absolutely nonsense. I think it's a question of telling yourself the whole truth about yourself, and then you'll feel much more comfortable about it.
What I'm interested in, though, is how a young man decides to come out in the sense of telling his parents that. Was that a big deal? What, did that take great courage to say to your father, there's something you should know, I am homosexual?
No, I didn't actually ever do that. It just happened. And I think it's, You know, I think everybody around me probably knew it all the time.
Next piece of music.
River Deep, Mountain High by Tina Turner. And this will make me think of my office family. I love my secretary, Aileen, and all the other people in my office. So I would think of them when this was being played.
And they just
River Deep, Mountain High, sung by Tina Turner. So you came back to England, Jasper. You worked briefly with Bill Gibb and for Wallace Shops, but very quickly, 1979, you set up your own business with a bank loan, and the rest is history, really.
Yes.
I wonder why, after such an unconventional beginning, when you started designing, your clothes were so conventional, so classic.
Yes, I know. Odd that, isn't it?
I thought you might design crocheted frocks.
You would have thought I'd design crocheted frocks and glitter high heels and all sorts. I think that there is a sort of very puritanical streak that runs through me. That, I think that probably there are two people in me. One is somebody who likes fun, but I also like navy blue and white and, you know, there's this other chap down there and he doesn't like that kind of thing at all. I think he's probably the slightly stronger chap of the two.
He's certainly the more astute businessman, as we were saying, because what you designed sold.
Definitely.
It worked.
That is definitely in my blood. I had to design clothes that sold because I wasn't going to get a second chance at that. I needed to have a business that worked.
And it did work, and you became, you were designer of the year in 1986, weren't you? But then suddenly in the late 80s, you hit financial disaster. What happened?
Well, not disaster, because I didn't go bankrupt, so that wasn't disastrous. Something awful did happen to me, which is that I hadn't realised that the rent on the building that we were in could go up six times from sort of 36,000 to a quarter of a million in one fell swoop.
But overnight?
Overnight. And I was very, very nearly wiped out by it. All the money we'd made just evaporated in the space of 3 years. I actually went to the liquidator because I couldn't go. I had nothing left. And he said, I cannot allow you to do this. I said, well, you haven't got much choice in the matter, have you? And he said, well, actually, I know the landlord. And he rang them up and they were persuaded that they'd pushed me as far as I could go.
But you don't do shows anymore, do you?
No. Absolute waste of money. I mean, what business do you know where you have to reinvent yourself every 6 months? I mean, it's mad. I'm in the business of making clothes. It's my craft. That's what I do. And in being in business.
I'm interested you call it a craft, because a lot of designers would call it an art.
Oh, it certainly is no art. We're dressmakers, that's all we are.
You say you're a businessman, but at the same time, you've gone into the theatre, haven't you? And I think when you first went into the theatre and started designing there, the costumes and so on, that you didn't do it as a kind of financial undertaking, did you?
Oh, no, I didn't. You know, we were talking about that Puritan in one side and the other chap on the other. That's what satisfies the other chap. Is being able to work in the theatre. There, all I have to do is please visually, you see. There, I'm telling a story with clothes, and I can do whatever I like, and I can play with colour to my heart's content. It's like painting. It's great.
Record number 6.
Edith Piaf singing La Vie en Rose. And I suppose that reminds me of France and the French, whom I love.
Des yeux qui font baisser les miens, un rire qui se perd sur sa bouche, voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. Quand il me prend dans ses la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour.
Edith Piaf singing La Vie en Rose. You're a francophile, Jasper. You own a house near Bordeaux,
yes,
which according to all descriptions is very plain and simple and uncluttered, and you've been quoted as saying that you don't care if people put their dirty shoes on the sofas, and because you can wash them and you like material that's been washed a lot. Should we believe that?
But why shouldn't you?
Well, because if I'd gone to some trouble to, you know, cover my sofas nicer, I wouldn't want people... You've also said you don't mind if people burn holes in them. I mean, are you really that relaxed about it all?
Yes. It's the countryside. There's a lot of dirt outside, and it's inevitable that a lot of it's going to come in. And I actually think if people are relaxed and having a nice time, then... Fine. I'm a realist, Sue.
You claim to be relaxed on the one hand, but you also are a minimalist. You don't like clutter about, do you?
No.
But, I mean, you can't be relaxing because you've got to rush around putting everything away. I mean, you can't leave the shampoo out in the bathroom and the books in the sitting room. Isn't it hard work being minimalist?
It's a terrible burden, Sue. I can't tell you how awful it is.
And you sit there in France, designing on a computer. You
yes.
Say, underneath the lime tree.
Yes. Just,
how often can you get there and do that?
I probably go there about once every 2 months for a week or so.
So you can send your designs back up the computer?
Yes, I can work on the computer and I can modem them through to London. And they spew out there, where they groan because they have to process them.
So it's really much like being on a desert island, really. You can sit yes. there on your own.
I think it's amazing that I love technology. I never, you know, a plane never takes off without me thinking, God, this is incredible.
Well, you can't have your computer on the desert island, unless you take it as your luxury, of course, but you can't be in contact. What will you do on your desert island? How will you go on? Will you build the shelter? Will you organise life?
I'm going to get to my desert island, actually. Well, no, I'll make a garden first. I'd make a vegetable garden, and I'd make a very attractive homestead, and that would have lots of Conran touches about it. I'd be very, very busy. I thought about this and I
would
have a lovely
shop,
time.
Would you?
I'd probably open a shop, yes. a restaurant. a small boutique.
So you'd have plenty of practical things to do to keep yourself busy. It'd just
yes.
be a matter of keeping your soul together, really. How would you do that? You have to stop talking again.
Yeah, the world would heave a sigh of relief, no doubt. But I think because I've learnt to be self-sufficient in my life and because I've never been bored in my life, ever. So just keeping yourself alive is going to be a 24-hour job down on my desert island. But it'll be nice because the water will be aquamarine and the palms will sway. I will try and make it enjoyable.
Record number 7.
Is Maria Callas singing the aria Visidate from Puccini's Tosca. The first time I heard Maria Callas's voice, I nearly burst into tears. I couldn't believe how beautiful it was. And this song in particular is all about how she did it for art.
Maria Callas singing the aria Visidate from Puccini's Tosca with the Orchestre de la Société des Concerts du Conservatoire, conducted by Georges Prêtre. We've made it sound like an awfully long life, this one, Jesper, but...
Golly, I know.
you're only 35. What are you going to do with the rest of it?
I love my work. I am privileged to be able to do the job I've always wanted to do. I think I'll probably troll along in much the same way. hopefully, because I am a lucky man.
But it's been, as you said, a bit of a struggle to get there, and not least because you've been the famous son of famous parents. Your father was quoted in one article not so very long ago saying, "I don't relate to Jasper as a father does to a son. He's more a friend to me."
I'm glad he said that I'm more of a friend than a son, because I would prefer that. That a friend is somebody you choose. A son is something you're lumbered with.
I see. And your mother, would you say at the end of the day she's been the greater influence on you? You're closer to her.
No, I'm not closer to either of them. I mean, I'm the same, I think. I have a different type of relationship with my father. It's a far more bucolic relationship, you know.
Bucolic?
Bucolic. Well, is that the right word? Is that... Have I used the wrong word again?
Well, bucolic means kind of ruddy of
pastoral.
Cheek, I think. And, oh, I see.
Pastoral and ruddy of cheek. You know, we do enjoy each other's company in a very calm, relaxed way.
I'm sure you wouldn't want to change your parents, and you can't anyway, and none of us should want to, but I wonder if at the end of the day you might have been happier had you been the son of Mr. and Mrs. Ordinary Achiever instead of Mr. and Mrs. Superbreed.
No, I wouldn't. I'm very, very, very thrilled and pleased to be exactly who I am.
Last record.
I've been talking about how lucky I am, and I have had a friend called Sue Fulston since I started work. And I think in life that it's your friends that get you by. And my friend Sue has done just that. And her favourite song is Diamonds Are Grail's Best Friend by Marilyn Monroe. And I would be reminded of her.
A kiss may be grand, but it won't pay the rental on your humble flat, or help you at the automat. Men grow cold as girls grow old, and we all lose our charms in the end. But square cut or pear shape, these rocks don't lose their shape. Diamonds are a girl's best friend.
Now, Lynn Monroe and Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. Now, if you could only take one of those eight records, Jasper, which one would it be?
I think it would have to be Maria Callas singing Vissidate.
Because
I did
record.
It all for art and for love.
What about your book?
I would take The Tales of Hoffman by Hoffman. I'm very lucky, you see, because I've got a terrible memory. So I can read a book from end to end and then go back again. They're the most beautiful collection of 18th century French tales. That's it. That's what I want.
They keep you going.
They keep me going.
And what about your luxury?
I thought about pens and paper, but I thought, no, I'd have to make my own. That would be a bit more of a challenge. And I thought about all sorts of things I might want, but actually, at the end of the day, what will make me feel really good is an endless supply of vintage Krug champagne.
Why not? Why not? Jasper Conran, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.